Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
But we start the day with another in our series, South by South of Houston, featuring some of the films that were meant to be shown at South by Southwest before it was canceled. Now, if you ever doubted the importance of accurate information, real news as opposed to fake, the coronavirus pandemic should convince you that the truth can be a matter of life and death. We need facts, and we need to get guidance from our leaders we can trust to be honest with us. And sometimes public figures themselves become victims of fake news. It happened to Hillary Clinton, and just this week, it happened to Oprah Winfrey. After friends called Oprah to tell her she was trending on Twitter, last night she tweeted around 1:30 in the morning to assure the world that she had not, in fact, been arrested for running a global sex trafficking ring. It's against this backdrop that a new documentary premieres on HBO, After Truth, Disinformation, and the Cost of Fake News, debuts tomorrow night. The film investigates the people behind some of the most notorious fake news incidents in the last several years. Traveling the propaganda pipeline from Reddit and 4chan to Facebook and Fox News, After Truth is fascinating and a little scary. Director Andrew Rossi and CNN chief media correspondent Brian Stelter, he's executive producer of the film, they join us now. Andrew, welcome.
Thank you, Allison. Great to be here.
Brian, thanks for coming on back to the show.
Thank you so much.
So, Andrew, you've worked with Brian before. Andrew has done the documentary Page One inside the New York Times. So, Andrew, what led you to this collaboration?
Well, it's right. Page One was also about quality journalism, and Brian had a pivotal role as one of the members of the media desk. But in that case, we were talking about the decline in print advertising and the importance of quality journalism without looking at the stakes of life and death, as you just mentioned. After Truth is sort of a sequel to Page One, but it's looking at how false stories can lead to real-world consequences, like the Pizzagate conspiracy, where Edgar Madison Welch went to the D.C. pizzeria with a shotgun. It's shocking that that story is actually trending this morning on Twitter, again, Pizzagate. And as you mentioned, Oprah's linked into it, and it's just one of these really disturbing conspiracies.
Brian, why did you want to make this documentary?
I think everybody knows the term fake news, and everybody knows that President Trump has tried to redefine that term and exploit it to his own ends. But oftentimes we talk about this disinformation problem like it's very clinical or academic. You know, it's something for regulators to worry about or for Facebook to worry about. And actually what disinformation is it's something that hurts people. It does damage to people's lives. It does damage to our country and to our society. And that's what we've tried to show in the film is the actual victims of these disinformation campaigns. Also, the perpetrators. What are they thinking? Why are they doing this? I mean, we've seen this in the past few weeks with the pandemic. So many bogus stories, bogus cures that are spreading on social media. And hey, at least this time around, the tech companies have done a better job of trying to stamp it out.
Let's get to one of those perpetrators you follow, Jack Berkman. You feature him in a film. In the film, I want to play a clip from him. He's a lobbyist and a very proud disseminator of this kind of news. Let's take a listen.
Fake news is a weapon, and we've even tried to use fake news. Fake news is a good way to drive a story. You know, you put up a site instead of New York 1, New York 2, and people believe it, and they reprint it, and it gets reprinted. It can be an effective tool in driving a story, you know. People use it. It's become a tool of war.
I almost feel like that music should be around him all the time, like in real life. And I wanted to share with our listeners something he posted on Twitter just this past Monday. Attention, do not obey the orders of the government to shut down your businesses due to an imaginary plague. These orders are unlawful. I urge all state legislatures to come into emergency session to draft a constitutional amendment that will limit D.C.'s powers over the people. Hashtag COVID-19. A lot.
Yeah.
So, Brian and Andrew, from making this film and from your research and your journalism, how does someone like him gain influence? Andrew, why don't you take it first?
Sure. Well, I mean, I think, you know, as you mentioned, he sort of should be walking around with that music. He's such a he's so rooted in this sort of pseudo-philosophical Twilight Zone kind of approach to things. And somehow there's this kind of moment in the culture where that approach to life makes people feel more comforted than the political messages that they're hearing from authorities. We've reached this point where experts and science and government officials make people feel, in some cases, less in control. And so he's really an expert, along with Jacob Wall, the other person who's in the film doing a smear on Robert Mueller, at exploiting people's fears and their prejudices to make these stories latch on.
Brian, as someone who has been a media journalist for a long time, how does someone like him gain influence?
There's always been these fringe characters, these conspiracy theorists and provocateurs, these smear artists. And the difference now is that they can get a much bigger following online. They can reach a much bigger audience. Because if you know, this stuff spreads without being checked and debunked, it can gain a big following. We start this film in 2015 when there's this military exercise conspiracy theory in Texas. But the term fake news started being used on the Internet in 2014 with Ebola, with the Ebola outbreak, when there were made-up stories trying to scare people about Ebola. Up until 2016, fake news really just meant made-up stories trying to trick people, either for propaganda or profit. But in the Trump age, that term has been redefined and exploited, as I said. And there's a lot of different kinds of disinformation. So we try to go through in the film all these different types of disinformation campaigns.
So, Andrew, you know, you follow around Berkman and his sidekick, Jacob Wall. And as you mentioned, he tried to slime Robert Mueller with this accusation of sexual assault. What was their MO? How did they want to go about this?
Well, that's one of the fantastic things that a film can do. I think there's always been this debate among documentary filmmakers, how can we capture these liars without giving them oxygen? And I hope we do that in the film, because we have a sort of observational cinema at our disposal. We're filming them with our cameras in real time as Jack Berkman and Jacob Wall discover that the accuser that they're planning to bring to this press conference will not be arriving to present the claims, the bogus claims. And we see them sort of strategizing how they're going to lie to the reporters so that they'll still attend the press conference. But the great thing is we see reporters like Adam Goldman of the New York Times, Will Sommer of the Daily Beast, Oliver Darcy of CNN, pushing back on their claims. I mean, they had a website that was completely bogus called Surefire Intelligence that had been registered to Jacob Wall's mother and claimed to be a professional investigation unit. They said that Robert Mueller was in New York when this event happened, and one of the reporters is able to say, well, no, there's records of him doing jury duty in D.C. They really go through all the claims and squash them down. So we get to see how they operate, but we also can fact check it in real time.
Brian, I'm just sort of curious about, they do not seem at all embarrassed that they're getting caught in what seems to be a big lie. They just, they just don't seem to care. Why
right.
is that?
I think shamelessness is something that has been certainly demonstrated to be beneficial in this Trumpy age among some provocateurs. But it doesn't work with most people, right? That's the thing. Yes, you can draw a little bit of a cult following by being shameless and not caring about whether you're telling people a truth or a falsehood. But most people want to know the truth. Most people want to be informed and told they're safe and all of that. So I think naming and shaming, calling out this behavior, does have an effect, at least for most people.
The name of the film is After Truth, Disinformation, and the Cost of Fake News. My guests are its director, Andrew Rossi, and executive producer, Brian Stelter. Brian, I want to circle back to Adam Goldman, who really handles this particular duo situation. But I'm curious, because he's from the New York Times. So
right.
If you're a believer of these two and people of who also believe, they're never going to believe someone like Goldman or what he writes. I mean, would it be more meaningful to have someone from, say, like the Washington Examiner busted these guys? Have they ever had sort of a more conservative source go after them?
You know, that's interesting. We have seen some fact-checking efforts in recent years from the Daily Caller and the Washington Examiner and other right-wing and right-leaning outlets, but there's not enough of it. What we see far too often is these right-wing websites are less about journalism and more about resentment news, where they're conjuring up anger and resentment about what other news outlets are actually doing the hard work and covering. I wish we could see more real, original reporting from those sorts of outlets. But, you know, we've seen it in the past week. What an incredible U-turn Fox News took, belatedly, when it comes to this pandemic. They had hosts on the air shamefully downplaying the threat posed by the pandemic. And then in recent days, Fox News took a turn and did change for the better. I think that may be an example of how naming and shaming things can actually have an impact. But it's also a broader, you know, recognition that you can fool some of the people some of the time. But when your family is at risk, when there's a storm coming, people can see the sky darken for themselves, and they start to wonder if they've been lied to by the people that told them it was going to be sunny. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I was interviewed a psychiatrist yesterday to talk about, you know, the panic and anxiety everybody's feeling right now, and he used the phrase social contagion. And I thought about it last night as I was watching the film when you're watching about what happened with the Seth Rich case, how this Democratic Party staffer who was killed near his home in Washington, police said it was a botched robbery, but then it was turned into this conspiracy that just sort of kept on going. Could you explain to our listeners, Andrew, where it started and how it became somewhat of a social contagion?
Yes, it's another one of these terrible conspiracies like Pizzagate, and it emerged during the election of 2016. The emails that were hacked by Russia were claimed by WikiLeaks to actually have come from Seth Rich, who was murdered during that summer. And people like Roger Stone and Jerome Corsi, who are right-wing propagandists and conspiracy theorists, latched onto it and helped to spread it. And that's one of the things that we see in the film, that there's a sort of propaganda pipeline. So the theory began spreading on 4chan and Reddit in these sort of corners of the internet. People like Stone and Corsi helped to make it more mainstream, and then it made its way all the way to Fox News, where Sean Hannity was speculating that Seth Rich was the source of the emails and the source of a leak, when in fact it was a hack by Russia. We see it as a very clear deflection or distraction tool that's used for political goals.
I'm curious about a lot of different things. But Brian, what do you understand about conspiracy theories now that you didn't understand before?
That they do bring people comfort, and that they do bring people a sense of satisfaction and a way to understand a really confusing, complex world. You know, think about how much of an information-saturated environment we are all in. We all have so much more access to so much more information than we did 30, even 20 years ago. Even basics, like how long it's going to take to drive to your studio, or really complicated information about the health and well-being of the population. And in that increasingly chaotic and information-saturated landscape, some people do want a simpler explanation of things, and a sense that some evildoers in dark corners are making their lives worse for various reasons. You know, I think that's partly what Pizzagate and Seth Rich are both about. The Seth Rich case is agonizing because Andrew was able to interview Seth's brother, Aaron. Mm-hmm. Aaron really hasn't given him many interviews. But you hear Aaron Rich say, "I haven't had a chance to grieve for my brother because I've been too busy trying to stomp out all these crazy people who were claiming my brother was a covert op, you know, or a spy." Like, that really hit it home for me that there are actually victims of disinformation. This is not just a regulatory problem. It's actually a victim. It's a story about victims.
Right. And I think, Allison, to your point, the stories are so compelling to certain people because they traffic in hate and sensational topics like the Clinton body count, which was in the Seth Rich conspiracy. Their narratives, just like, any other story, but they have the compelling component of pushing people's emotional buttons. There's like an emotional engine to them that sometimes the truth in reality doesn't have. I mean, we're in a crisis right now that's really hard to wrap one's head around. There's no rhyme or reason. There's no one to blame, But if somehow people like Oprah and other deep state players can be wrapped into some story, then it makes people feel better that there is actually some cause or some logic to it, even if it's false.
You know, Andrew, I would never say poor Oprah, but today for the first time I actually say poor Oprah. Because you know, this theory was so crazy overnight about QAnon and eating babies, all that crazy stuff they were targeting Oprah with. But my question in that case is, what are her rights? You know, I know we all have the right to publish online. That's a beautiful thing. And some people are really able to benefit from that. But shouldn't she have some rights also to fight back? And obviously, as a public figure, she can. But I worry about the people who get smeared online who don't have the power to fight back like Oprah does.
The sentence, "You're trending on Twitter," makes my blood run cold.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. Never let me trend.
The name of the film is After Truth, Disinformation, and the Cost of Fake News. My guests are director Andrew Rossi and executive producer Brian Stelter. Facebook, you take on Facebook in the film as well. Now that you finish the film and you've watched it, what could Facebook do to fix its fake news problem?
I think one thing that we see that's happening now is much more attention to moderating the specific topic of coronavirus, and everyone seems to agree that it is that you know lives are at stake in order to sanitize the information space. I think that needs to be the approach at all times because, as we're saying, you know there are victims to these fake stories. They do pollute the information space in a way that has catastrophic implications in an event like this. Facebook needs to get rid of political ads in general and certainly not have false information in them. I think that's a threshold matter. And then they also need to, I think, cultivate a different culture in terms of the information that's spread. I mean, you know, the people who develop these platforms are in large part white men who don't understand how hate can really target marginalized communities. They weren't built in a way that protects certain populations that get smeared with information and who can suffer. And I think that they need to recalibrate the conversation that's there. You know, free speech and the First Amendment is what they always cite, but they're private companies, they're platforms that can be moderated. They just don't want to take that step because they're profiting.
And Brian, last question for you. We've been talking about fake news, and it's the current president. He really likes those two words together, but he's not in your film a tremendous amount. Why did you all make that decision?
That's intentional because this is an issue bigger than the president, and it'll be with us long after the president leaves office. You know, the heart of this film is in places like Texas, far from the coast, you know, where these are stories that are affecting everybody. They affect New Yorkers and Texans, and we wanted to make that point. And it's broader than President Trump. You know, right now this is the world's worst game of whack-a-mole, and it's constantly being played because disinformation is getting more and more sophisticated. But if you don't play the game, then the liars win, the cheats win, and sometimes that involves the president. The president does lie about the media and to the media all the time. But I do think that calling that out, debunking his falsehoods is part of the issue, but it's not the entire issue. You know, this is an environment, an information environment that continues to be polluted. But all of us in our individual ways can take steps to help make it less polluted, whether you're a Facebook executive, whether you're a user, whether you're an educator. This is something we're all doing together.
My guests have been Andrew Rossi and Brian Stelter. Their new film is called After Truth, Disinformation, and the Cost of Fake News. It debuts tomorrow night on HBO. Andrew and Brian, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Allison.